Our second case this morning is 2020-1129, Ohio Public Works Commission versus the Village of Barnesville et al. For the appellant, Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court.
Counsel, will you pull your microphone a little closer?
Certainly. Apologize. As you mentioned, I'm Dan Gibson for Gulfport Energy Corporation. With me at council table is Robert McClelland, who is counsel for the Village of Barnesville, but I'll be arguing on behalf of all appellants today. If it pleases the court, I would request to reserve 6 minutes of my time for rebuttal. A member of the general public could be forgiven for wondering why we are even here today. This case and the facts of this case, like the companion cases before this court, is a story of how Ohio has successfully engaged a public policy of environmental conservation and at the same time of technological innovation in the development of natural resources. And indeed, the properties that were purchased with the assistance of Clean Ohio grant funds for the purpose of being preserved as open spaces are and continue to be preserved as open spaces. As the Commission has acknowledged, the surface of the properties have not been used. However, since 2014, Gulfport Energy Corporation has also been, pursuant to a permit from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, developing the minerals 1.5 miles beneath the surface of these properties. Apparently, unbeknownst to the Commission, who was totally unconcerned and unaware of this fact, until apparently it consulted publicly available well summaries on the eve of this appeal. To anyone other than a bunch of lawyers and bureaucrats, I would submit this would be viewed as an entire win-win. Ohio embracing environmental conservation and also technological innovation to develop its natural resources. But instead, it is a story of how the Public Works Commission took its charge to administer the Clean Ohio Grant Program to impose upon grantee properties a draconian and unlawful restraint on the alienability of that property, and is now utilizing that restraint in an effort not only to halt this environmentally sound and non-disturbing production of the surface of the properties, but also to demand that it receive, as relief for this alleged breach, a sum of money that would equal 2 times the amount of the grant that they gave in exchange for the deed restrictions for every single paper transaction that facilitated this mineral development.
Counselor, the language of the contract said declarant shall not voluntarily or involuntarily sell, transfer, assign, lease, et cetera, or otherwise encumber without prior written consent.
Correct, Your Honor.
Was there a request for written consent?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
And that was denied?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the assigning of the rights, you went ahead with that?
The Village of Barnesville did go ahead with that, Your Honor, yes.
Finding that was not in derogation of the contractual obligation to have written approval?
I don't know that there's anything in the record that indicates why or the reasoning of the Village, but I certainly think that's a fair understanding, that they concluded that it would be best to ask for permission, but ultimately that to lease the minerals for a non-surface disturbing development process was not a breach.
So best to ask for approval, but not required?
Absolutely. And to be honest, Your Honor, I don't know that the Village necessarily came to the conclusion that we have advanced in this case, which is that the alienation restraint is simply void as contrary to public policy. Certainly the factual history is in the record, at least on the summary judgment motions that were filed, but it's not material to the ultimate disposition of the alienation restraint, because it's either a valid legal provision or it's not, according to Ohio public policy. And we would submit that as a matter of public policy, both with regard to oil and gas development and alienation restrictions, it is fundamentally inconsistent with Ohio public policy. And indeed, the Commission acknowledges both of those public policies. There's no quarrel here that the alienation restraint is fundamentally inconsistent with the Anderson versus Carey statement more than 100 years ago that to encumber a fee simple estate with a prohibition, particularly an absolute, unlimited, and perpetual limitation on the alienability of that property, is philosophically inconsistent with the very concept of a fee simple. But it is also the case that it is fundamentally inconsistent with Ohio's strong public policy of promoting oil and gas development. And this is found both in legislative language with regard to properties that are owned or controlled by the state. In fact, this court could very easily conclude that to the extent that there is any kind of interest in this property by the commission, that this qualifies as state-controlled land. But it need not come to that conclusion, because the Newberry case also says that for property that is privately owned or owned not by the state of Ohio, there is a robust public policy supporting the and promoting the development of the natural resources of oil and gas beneath those properties as well.
But when the deed contains the plain language that an injunction is the proper tool for enforcing the language that's in the deed, I mean, that's been around since 1900, and I don't think anything's really overturned that. I mean, you can talk about public policy, but it's the language in the deed.
I would say two things, Your Honor. I don't think you first answer or reach the question of the remedies unless there's a conclusion that the provision in question has been breached, and it can't be breached if it's not sustainable under Ohio public policy. But secondarily, the deed doesn't indicate that it's enforceable by injunction. It says it's enforceable by equity. And one of the things that we make clear in the brief is that the statutory requirement for the remedies that are associated with an alleged breach of the long-term ownership and control requirements includes repayment of the grant, which is a rescissionary remedy, and as this court has long recognized, rescission is an equitable remedy. So the word equity does not do all of the work that the commission would suggest in saying, therefore, we have carte blanche to pursue any injunction to halt any of this activity.
So are you saying the language of the deed steps outside the statute?
I'm saying that the language of the deed is consistent with the statute if equity is interpreted to mean the rescissionary remedy that the General Assembly mandated. If it were to be concluded that it was injunctive relief, I believe it would be inconsistent with the statute. Not directly inconsistent with the statute. The statute doesn't say injunctive relief is prohibited, but it does say that grant repayment is required in the event of a breach of long-term ownership and control requirements. And if the grant is rescinded, then there is nothing left to be enforced going forward. Now, as I indicated before, I would submit to the court it need not reach the remedies question, because the status quo is a perfectly consistent state of affairs with the entire purposes of the grant program. Well,
let me ask you this. Suppose we find that, suppose we agree with you about the deed restriction, about the transfer restriction, but there's void, but we find that this is a violation of the use restriction because the property is being used for something other than open space, then what do we do? What should we do with the case?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think part of it would depend on how the court reached the conclusion. I would remind Your Honor that the only actual predicate for a breach that was articulated were the transfer, not the actual production that's occurring. That's only come about as a source of discussion at this appeal level. But let's assume, just for the sake of discussion, that you find a breach of the use restriction on either basis.
Or would we have to, in that situation, remand it to see if the use restriction was breached?
Well, if this court found that the use restriction was breached, then it would go to the deed and look at the enforcement language. And the enforcement language says that for any breach of the restrictions set forth in the deed, the remedy is liquidated damages and grant repayment. That means liquidated damages, as we have articulated in the brief, is an explicit acknowledgement that those liquidated damages are an adequate legal remedy.
It also provides for equitable relief. Would the state get to elect which one they wanted?
They would not. And
so
this
the,
is
the equitable relief is meaningless in there. It can only be the liquidated damages?
It is meaningless in there for two reasons. Not meaningless. It is not meaningful in the injunctive relief sense. It is meaningful in the sense of the rescissionary remedy, which the General Assembly statutorily required in grant repayment, is equitable relief. And so that equity that is referenced in the deed, I believe, is best interpreted as an equitable remedy of rescission, which they are required to pursue pursuant to statute. But as a matter of injunctive relief, as a secondary question, the court would still have to ask, if liquidated damages have been stipulated to in the contract for a past completed breach, which is what this is, then Liquidated damages are an acknowledgement of the legal adequacy of their remedy. So just because they would potentially have a theoretical right to pursue equitable or injunctive relief under the theory of injunction, they still would have to demonstrate irreparable harm. And by stipulating in their contract that a liquidated damages remedy is a compensation for any breach of the deed restrictions, they will have foreclosed that remedy to themselves. And this court's decision in the New York, name escapes me, case clearly indicates that in the case of deed restrictions, when a party is stipulated to a particular remedy, it is to be held to that remedy. So I don't think that there's any inconsistency in holding them to that remedy as a matter of the deed language construction and still recognizing that the equity language can be a reference to the rescissionary remedy that the statute, the General Assembly required.
But let me ask you one more question. Your view is obviously that the use restriction only applies to the surface. But if we take a different view and say that use of the property only as open space means you can't use any of the property other than as open space and you can't have drilling there, do we have to remand that to the trial court to see if there has been a violation of that, or is the record clear that is a transfer of the is a transfer enough to violate that? I mean, is there evidence of actual drilling in the record? Or
not in the record. We readily acknowledge that the drilling is occurring and that the commission apparently wasn't even aware of it when they filed their complaint, even though it was a matter of public record. But no, transfers, I mean, if the court were to hold, I think it would have a lot of collateral consequences, but the notion that a transfer, a paper transfer of interests constitutes an impermissible use of property, that would be a rather peculiar holding, but then ultimately the court will have found that there was a breach simply by virtue of those transfers. If, on the other hand, the court concludes that the transfers are not sufficient, I would submit that on the record that is before this court and the theory that the commission has pursued up to this court, the case should be dismissed because they have asserted only a transfer-based theory of breach. However, I would certainly, ask that the court even acknowledge and address the fact that a production of oil and gas a mile and a half beneath the surface, which is acknowledged not to have done anything to the surface of the property, is not in fact a breach, both because it's not a use of the property, it's development of the minerals beneath it, but also because it is not a violation of the open space intent. And this goes to the construction rules that is one of the more eye-opening elements of the commission's position here, which is that to the extent there's any discussion of how to construe the use restriction, their position appears to be that it ought to be construed as restrictively as possible. A mile and a half beneath the property.
Isn't a fairly common sense reading? It says use of the property only as open space. The property is being used for drilling, so it's not being used only for open space. And that seems...
Well, actually, pursuant to a number of cases, including this court's cases, the discussion of the word use is particularly instructive. In the oil and gas context, the word use is typically employed for the purpose of describing the use of the surface to access the minerals. Today, we're talking about deep lateral drilling, which is not even, there is no well pad anywhere on the property. And so the notion of what is actually occurring beneath this property is not a use of the property, but it is simply a development of the minerals from the property. Secondarily, I would submit that the rules of construction with regard to deed restrictions like the use restriction suggest that the free use of land should be the presumption. Now, in this case, clearly, the description of what is required is a use of the property as an open space. But to suggest that that is somehow now a prohibition on deep mineral development that the commission acknowledges has not used the surface at all would be a rather peculiar interpretation, and I would submit it is not unambiguous to the extent that that wouldn't be an inversion of this court's rules of construction.
So your definition of use only includes the surface use of the property. That's the only thing that is subject to that limitation.
In this context, Your Honor, yes. When you have a use restriction that says that the property ought to be used only for open space and recreational appurtenances, I think it's clear, for starters, that the intent of the restriction is to preserve the open space. But as we also point out in the brief, open space is defined actually as the non-use of property. And so in a peculiar way, you have a use restriction, even though it is an exclusive permitted use restriction, is really a statement that the property ought not to be used in a way that makes it not an open space. But as the commission acknowledges, the property is still an open space.
So what happens if a drone convention wants to use this space, and people might not even have to be on that land, but there are so many drones in the air, but they're not on the ground, and they're not below the ground. Is that okay or not?
I think it's an interesting question, Your Honor. I don't know the property law with regard to airspace and utilization, but in terms of the actual drilling beneath the surface, the one thing that is clearly different about that is that that would at least be detectable from the surface. I think it's a different scenario. I don't know if it comes out different legally, but it is clearly not the situation we have before the court, which is one where the commission didn't even know that production was occurring until.
So one more question on remedies. Let's say that somehow the subsurface drilling, or maybe there's even the bearing of effluents, causes some kind of disturbance on the land up above, as it has in places like Trumbull County, and that's when they were drilling, putting the injection wells in. Is liquidated damages good enough, or is an injunction needed?
I would say two things. One is the deed that the commission agreed to says liquidated damages is good enough. Whether I think it is or not, or public policymakers think it is or not, it clearly says that for any breach of these restrictions, liquidated damages are compensation for a breach. But secondarily,
but you're forgetting the equity part.
Correct, and as I indicated, I think that the equity part is a reference to the rescissionary remedy in the statute dealing with long-term ownership and control. But to the extent that there is an open question, I would submit, yes, that's a very different question. My position does not require me to say that they would be without a remedy in the event that the surface was actually disturbed by the drilling. But I don't know how I would come out on that speculatively, but my position does not require me to say they have no injunctive remedy in that scenario.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Peterson.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. If I may, I'd like to take the three propositions of law at issue in this case in reverse order. I'd like to deal first with the third proposition of law, because the use restriction is unique to this case. And I'd like to explain under that why a violation of the use restriction has occurred. Then I'd move on to the two propositions that are identical to the propositions that this court is already considering in the Siltstone case. And under the second proposition, I'd like to explain why an injunction is available and why that will not necessarily result in a double recovery for the Public Works Commission. And finally, if I may, I would conclude by explaining why the transfer restriction is valid and enforceable. So turning to the use restriction. The use restriction here, as Justice DeWine noted, says this property may only be used for two purposes: open space with trails and passive recreational appurtenances. Now, this is different than the use restriction that was issued in the Siltstone case. There, you had a primary use and an authorization for any use that was not inconsistent with that primary use. And the difference in the plain language explains why the Seventh District ruled differently in this case and in Siltstone. And it explains why there has been a violation here. Because I think we would all agree that however you characterize open space with trails and passive recreational appurtenances, oil and gas development is not something someone engages in for the purposes of recreation. In our theory.
But here you've got oil and gas a mile down with no effect on the surface. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. And that explains why the Seventh District found that there was no violation of the broader permitted uses in Siltstone. And it explains why it's different here. Because here, the fact that the deed does not mention subsurface activity simply means that it is not one of the two permitted uses. The Seventh District importantly held that these restrictions, the transfer restriction and the use restriction, apply to the property as a whole. And that aspect of that decision has not been appealed. And so from our perspective, that's law of the case, that these restrictions apply to the entirety of the property. And this court's precedent says subsurface mineral rights are part of property. And so the fact that the deed restriction is silent simply means that there is no permitted, authorized subsurface activity. And I'd like to touch on briefly their theory of that there must be an actual use in order to violate this use restriction. First, that's legally incorrect, and second, it's factually irrelevant. Legally, this court has never required an actual use before authorizing an injunction. I point the court to the Wallace v. Clifton Land case and the Berger v. Van Swearingen case. And in Berger, for example, there was a proposal to build a shopping mall up near Cleveland on property that was deed restricted. And the court didn't require that that shopping mall actually begin construction. It allowed an injunction when it was simply proposed. Here we have more than a proposal. When this lease was signed, that was a concrete legal step taken towards a violation. And in that point, whatever else you may say about when an injunction is available, I think it is enough for the court to say when there's a concrete legal step taken by parties with the intent to do something that violates the use restriction, that is enough to authorize an injunction.
But you want damages too, right?
And that goes to my second point, Your Honor. We have requested damages, but damages will only be appropriate in some cases. And this is why there is no threat of a double recovery. And I'd like to tell the tale of two different oil companies who were both involved in this case: Gulfport, who you heard from, and Eclipse, which is no longer part of this case. Both of those entities signed oil and gas leases. Eclipse never did anything with them. And so when we filed suit, they released their interest and were dismissed from the case. We did not seek damages from them because the property interest that had been transferred away under the transfer restriction went back to Barnesville, and it was the same property interest. So there was no basis to seek damages. And Gulfport, however, has stood up here and they have acknowledged that they have conducted oil and gas development. And so the question, and you don't need to decide this now, you simply need to say that these may be available. So the question for the court on remand will be, is the property interest that Barnesville impermissibly conveyed away the same as the property interest that may be conveyed back if an injunction is granted ordering the reunification of the property? And the answer may be yes, and the answer may be no. We think that the answer is probably yes, because the question will be, at the beginning of this case, Barnesville had a bundle of sticks, and they transferred some of those sticks away to Gulfport. If Gulfport gives back the sticks, are they the same sticks or are there fewer? And we think we will be able to prove in the trial court that they are fewer, but that is a question for the trial court and is not one that the court needs to confront now.
If you can show that somehow the property is diminished because of this, that you're entitled to damages?
I think that is.
And an injunction?
Yes, Your Honor, because the damages would be retrospective. They would be backwards looking for the reduction.
But the state wouldn't have lost anything by the oil being taken from there.
Your Honor, in this case, the question is, the state doesn't own this property at all. The Public Works Commission is not a property owner, but it does own property rights. It has rights in these deeds. I point the court to the deeds there, Exhibit D and Exhibit H, and they were attached to our motion for judgment on the pleadings. And those are the deeds, and they show that we have rights to these properties. They are restrictive covenants that run in favor of the Public Works Commission. And one of those rights is to prevent unauthorized transfers of the property. And so, yes, the state does not own any actual property, but it has a right to make sure that the conditions are not violated and that Barnesville retains all of the property that was purchased with public money. Because it's important to remember, the funds for these properties were provided by the public at large, because the Clean Ohio Conservation Fund was twice adopted by the voters of Ohio in order to preserve property. And the General Assembly determined that in order to preserve that property, grant recipients are required to maintain long-term ownership and control. And Barnesville has not done that. And so as long as the transfer restriction...
Well, why do you need the transfer restriction if you have the use restriction?
There are two reasons, Your Honor. One, and what we would say the primary reason is, the General Assembly has set eligibility criteria for parties that may receive grant funds. And in 164.23A and 127 164.27.
Okay, but why can't the use restrictions protect those?
Well, they have said that only local governments and private nonprofits are eligible to receive funds. And so the transfer restriction ensures that parties like Barnesville can't acquire funds and serve as a straw man for entities like Gulfport or Commercial Development who would not be eligible to receive the funds all on their own. And so that's the first primary
purpose. They wouldn't be receiving the funds. I mean,
but they would be receiving the property purchased with those funds. And so in order to prevent a straw man situation where parties acquire property using public dollars when they wouldn't be eligible for those public dollars themselves, the General Assembly has imposed the transfer restriction. And there's a second purpose, and it works hand in glove with the use restriction. Because here, if the transfer restriction had worked as intended, if Barnesville hadn't disregarded it, we would not need to be here asking questions about damages and whether there'd be a double recovery, because the Public Works Commission could have prevented an impermissible use in the first instance. If Barnesville would have heeded the instructions of the Public Works Commission and not signed these oil and gas leases, there would be no need to question, is the property diminished? Is it being used for an impermissible purpose? Because it would have never happened in the first place.
Council, now that we're on transfer, what gives the Public Works Commission the authority under the statute to put this deed restriction in the deed, considering the statute says long-term control through a lease or the purchase of an easement? This is not a lease or an easement, is it?
I think it can properly be characterized as an easement, Your Honor. And
I would say these will
be commonly characterized as negative easements, a prohibition on doing something. So there's two reasons. One, there's the common law recognition of what a common negative easement is, and just how easement is often used by the General Assembly in other contexts. If I may, I begin with the second other use. Because the General Assembly has other types of easements, agricultural use easements and conservation easements. In the conservation easement context, they said an easement can be in the form of articles of dedication, easement, covenant, restriction, or condition. And so that shows that when the General Assembly talks about easement, it often talks about easement in a broader context that includes other types of restrictions.
But it didn't do so here.
I think, Your Honor,
correct.
They did not use that specific language here.
That similar language from the conservation, they didn't use that.
But it shows, Your Honor, that what they mean when they say easement often is a broader concept that applies in the common law context, for example.
But why didn't they then say that?
Well, because they didn't necessarily need to, Your Honor, because it is a recognition under the common law that negative easements are forms of easements, and so a restriction prohibiting certain uses can properly be characterized as a negative easement. And so, yes, the General Assembly could have included additional language, but it didn't need to, because under the common law, these principles are well recognized that a restriction, yes, it can be called a restriction, but it also can be characterized as a negative easement. And I don't think the response that the parties on the other side have offered is that, well, all of those cases involve use restrictions. They haven't disagreed that a restriction on property can be characterized as a negative easement. It's just they've pointed, said, oh, we've only pointed to use restrictions. But that doesn't mean that it has to be.
Is it your argument they can't, that Barnesville cannot alienate the property below?
That is our argument, Your Honor.
So that's not a negative easement. That's an alienation issue.
But I think that is a negative easement on how the property may be transferred.
But not used.
But ownership is, because the General Assembly didn't just say maintain long-term control. It said maintain long-term ownership. And this is a method of doing so that is consistent with the General Assembly's language. What's telling is they don't have an answer for what 164.26 means. They do not provide an answer for what long-term ownership and control means. And so not only do we think that there's an explicit statutory command that authorizes these restrictions, but we think that this is the plain language of the deed to which Barnesville agreed in exchange for public dollars. And so we think you don't even need to get to their argument about the other aspects of this. And we think that if you point to the court's decision in Ohio Society for Crippled Children, that these types of restrictions are consistent with the public purpose and the language that's found there, because it said a restriction on alienation will generally be upheld if it's for a charitable or other public purpose. And so I know they would like to read that more narrowly to be a specific charitable trust requirement, but that's not what Ohio Society for Crippled Children says. And so I think that the statute, we think, favors us, we think, but it certainly does not mean that this is an illegal restriction. And
but doesn't it limit the agency's right or authority?
I don't think it limits it. I don't think that this these types of restrictions would violate that language, no. I think that it is a command to the agency, to the director of the Public Works Commission, to adopt policies requiring long-term ownership and control.
Through a lease or purchase?
Through.
Of an easement?
Yes.
Where was the purchase of the easement, of the negative easement?
I think that the purchase of the negative easement was through the grant agreement, because these deed restrictions are in the deed.
Correct.
The purchase of the easement occurred as part of the grant agreement, because as part of that, because what we're seeing, as part of that grant agreement, we said we were going to provide you these funds as long as you record these restrictions. So that grant
deed
agreement,
restriction, not an easement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I am accustomed
Correct.
To read. No, I would disagree. I still would characterize this as an easement under the terms of the statute. I think it can also be referred to as a restriction. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I'd like to briefly, if I may, touch on the discussion of whether an injunction is available, because I don't think has properly characterized the law or the nature of this deed. The law, in page, we pointed to 33 and 34 of our brief, and 37 and 38, is that simply the presence of a liquidated damages clause does not mean that there is a lack of irreparable injury. And so simply because the deed has liquidated damages clause does not mean that we have limited ourselves to that relief. And I don't think that is a proper characterization of the deed and what the Public Works Commission said or did in the deed. And I think it is inconsistent with established precedent. I think it's especially inconsistent with precedent from this court and from other courts, recognizing that when you're dealing with land, land is unique, and injunctive relief is warranted to ensure specific performance, and that damages are not sufficient when it comes to questions of land. I'd like to take one step back in my final 30 seconds here and make a broader point. This court in Wallace and Berger made the point that when parties take property, knowing that it is subject to a deed restriction, and then seek to avoid or ignore that restriction, the court will be skeptical of their arguments, going so far as to say they lack standing and equity. And that is exactly what Barnesville and Gulfport did here. They knew these restrictions were contingent on public funds. They knew these restrictions applied before the lease agreement was signed, yet they went ahead and did it anyway. And so we think that principle should call for the court to apply great skepticism to the arguments that they are making here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, if you've used your time, you may take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The use restriction can fairly be described as a negative easement. The alienation restraint cannot. And that's really the point here, which is, as a conservation easement, the use restriction serves the entire purposes of the grant program. And the alienation restriction is simply a mechanism by which the commission now has brought about a theory of transactional breach to this entire case to suggest that any transfers of any interests whatsoever are somehow violative of the entire grant program, even though the open space is still in pristine condition. I would submit to the court that there are three things the court should hold in the conclusion of this matter. The first is that the alienation restriction is void as against public policy. And the court need only ask the question, where is the abrogation of the two public policies that both parties acknowledge anywhere in either the constitutional provision or in the statutory scheme that the General Assembly enacted? As is clear from the Commission's position, what they have advocated for is for this court to create a public purpose exception to the alienability presumption in Ohio real property law. That would mean that every public entity in the entire state of Ohio is now entirely unbound by the rules requiring the alienability of fee simple estates, because every act that they do is a public interest exception. Second, the court should hold that there has been no breach of the use restriction. There is acknowledged to be no surface use whatsoever on a property that was designed to be preserved as an open space. And in order to conclude that the deep mineral development a mile and a half beneath it violates the use restriction, the court would either have to conclude that transactions are violative uses of property, or it would have to abrogate the public policies that are at issue in the transfer restriction. Because if the use restriction is also enforceable against and to prohibit oil and gas production that far beneath the surface without disturbing the surface, then the use restriction itself, too, is a violation of Ohio public policy promoting oil and gas development. And the commission offers no response to that because it is unclear. Their position as a matter of policy is as incomprehensible as it is wrong as a matter of law. Why does the oil and gas production that is having no impact on your conservation project have to be stopped? There is no answer. And finally, the remedies question is moot if there is no breach. But if there is a breach, it is inconceivable that the commission could go forward and recover the enormous sums of money far beyond anything that it ever awarded in the grant, which constitute a complete rescission of the grant agreement, and still go forward and enforce those deed restrictions by injunctions going forward. And the analysis that my opposing counsel indicated about the right of injunctive relief for prospective harm is for imminent actions that will breach in the future. It is not for the remedy of past completed breaches where there is an acknowledgement that the liquidated damages are an adequate remedy at law. They have never pled and never asked for a preliminary injunction for any future prospective transfers or transactions in this property. The court should reverse the 7th District below, respectfully. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?